And that is very much what the organization does by trying to build international partnerships where we can work in civil society to promote solutions which we know exist to the systems that have been imposed upon us. So with a warm welcome, I'm going to say hello to Kevin Donner.
Can you hear me up there? Oh, what power. Makes me feel like I'm Rush Limbaugh. Let me say a few words about my organization. Is that too loud? No, it's okay, man. You can stand it. I'll try not to yell. I can't yell at my kids, so I can't yell at you either. Global Exchange was started in 1988. We're an international human rights organization, a nonprofit, obviously, based down in San Francisco. We're now up to about 49 full-time staff. We have 4 stores, 1 cyber store and 3 bricks and mortar stores, 1 in San Francisco, 1 in Berkeley, 1 in Portland. Those are all doing quite well, thank you very much. These stores function as a way to assist development groups in third world countries, women's groups, handicapped groups, peasant groups, whatever, that are producing some product that we can bring to the United States and sell with them making the money, because we're a nonprofit, right? We're not Nike. I wouldn't mind having Philip Knight's money. He's worth about $5 or $6 billion. I don't know what these people do with that much money. They must have huge cocaine habits or something. But anyway, I guess you'd burn your septum out eventually. We take people on reality tours. Last year we did 142 reality tours. We did 90 to Cuba. The Bush administration this year eliminated the people-to-people provision in the travel ban, so our trips will be cut probably in half, but we'll still go. We used to do bicycle tours in Cuba, and the Treasury Department decided that those were not educational. They're not educational, they're transformative. You're bicycling across Cuba, meeting people at the village level. It changes people at the spiritual level. And the Treasury Department, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, that's the section, they obviously are experts in education, as opposed to us who have PhDs in this stuff and actually do education. They know more about it than we do, right? It's ridiculous. It's 1984 squared, right? And this is basically our nonverbal understanding of the world. Most people make the mistake of using the nation state as the unit of analysis, and they say the United States, Mexico, and Canada signed NAFTA. That's not true. It's these people up here who signed NAFTA. Most people in the United States wouldn't know NAFTA from HAFTA, from CAFTA, from SPLAFTA, from whatever. Right? Go out on the street and ask people to give you one sentence about the International Monetary Fund, the FTAA, the WTO, whatever. It's secret global government. Whenever you do conservative radio, I find that a very useful phrase when you're talking about the WTO, whatever, to a conservative crowd. You say, are you in favor of secret global government? What? Well, that's what these institutions are. You know, they're freaked out about the UN. Forget the UN, right? It's these financial organizations like the WTO, the IMF. And I've done these books, Democratizing the Global Economy, which is about the IMF and the World Bank, Globalize This, which is about the WTO. Corporations are going to get your mama. For the people you know who don't care about third world countries getting screwed, but they care about this country, and it's about how the corporations have taken over our society. Our most recent book is called Insurrection, Citizen Challenges to Corporate Power. It's about successful corporate accountability struggles and what we can learn from those struggles. And my most recent, or one of my recent books, it's called 10 Reasons to Abolish the IMF and the World Bank. You can see it's very thin, fits in your pocket. It's basically a succinct critique of the corporate capitalist global economy in very straightforward language with spiritual, economic, political, etc. aspects. And you'll notice up on the table back there and down here, I've got a lot of our newsletters. Please take them so I don't have to drag them back with me on the plane. You'll notice that in the middle, there is a membership envelope. This is how we survive. It's how we can be as radical as we are and get away with it and still have a big staff that gets paychecks. We have thousands of members around the country who write us small checks. So if you become a member today, I'll give you a free copy of one of these books as a little inducement. I'm not beyond that. What I want to talk about is, I almost forgot. Bite my tongue. There are also sheets up there for Bike Aid. Bike Aid is a thing we do in the summer that involves people, groups of people riding bicycles across country in a group, stopping in communities along the way to talk about globalization and how it relates to what's going on in the local community. So the group learns from the local community what's going on there, what are the issues, and you get to bring with them stuff about immigration and NAFTA and the WTO and all this, and there's all this good interaction. And this has been going on for about 10 or 12 years now. It's a very successful program. I want to start with a little bit of critique of the left. If you step back and you look at most of the statements of the left, it's sort of cult of powerlessness. Most of the narrative is about them, right? System sucks. Bush is a jerk. Capitalism, the corporations, and I'm guilty of this as anybody. This is self-critique as well. 90-some percent of our narrative is a narrative about them. And I think we need to start shifting to the narrative about us, okay? Let's picture it this way. You got the system is here. Picture it like a boat. Let's call it the Titanic, right? And it's going down. It's sinking. We've got a massive social inequality crisis. There's 1.2 billion people that are absolutely destitute on the planet right now. There are more people destitute on the brink of starvation right now than there were entire population of the planet 100 years ago. These are people who are trying to survive on a dollar a day. If you look at the distribution of world resources, if you divided the world into quintiles, fifths, and this is your poorest 20% down at the bottom, and this is your richest 20% at the top, and you plotted onto this graph the consumption of world resources, it looks something like this. 86% of global resource consumption is consumed by the richest 20% of people in the world. If you feel that this is a guilt trip, so be it. Guilt is a condiment, okay? A little bit of guilt is okay, but you don't want too much. It paralyzes people, you know? Spoils the broth. That means that 80% of the world's people are trying to survive on 14% of the world's resources. And this is a very broad UN measure of food, metals, minerals, wood, etc. Right? And this, in case you didn't catch on, this is us, okay? So here's an exercise you can do to get people to get their heads screwed on right. You say to a group of people, close your eyes, and I'm going to say a word. Actually, we can do it right now. Close your eyes, and I'm going to say a word. And when I say this word, I want you to visualize a group of people on the back of your eyelids, in your mind's eye. You ready? Close your eyes. Men, too. Men have trouble with trusting enough. It's all right. I'm not going to do anything to you. Okay, close your eyes and get ready. I'm going to say this word, and you're going to visualize people. The word is overpopulation. Okay, now you can open your eyes. Now, chances are, if you're like most people in this country, you visualized dark-skinned people. Is it dark-skinned people that are using up the world's resources? I don't think so, right? It's the colonizing powers, which are largely from the global north, Europe, U.S., right? Not always by race, because the Japanese colonized and murdered people in China, etc. So it's a class thing. It's a power thing. It's these alliances, these transnational elite alliances, whether it's back 100 years ago under colonialism or today in the modern neo-colonial world, where these connections would be things like General Electric coming into the Philippines and bribing the government so they can build a nuclear power plant next to an active volcano. That's a real example. The World Bank. I just met this morning in a class with people from about 10 or 12 different countries from the global south, and when I was talking about World Bank IMF policies, they're going, "Ooh, that's my country!" Yeah, and it resonates because they come in, they bribe these third world elites with massive loans, it's debt that has to be repaid back, and what they want is, they want access to two things. They want access to the human creativity of these countries, the labor at low wages, no trade unions, thank you very much, and nature. You got trees, we want to cut them down. You got coastline, we want to fish the hell out of it. You got minerals in the ground, we want to rip it out. Zaire, now the Republic of the Congo in Central Africa, has massive resources of cobalt and copper and gold and hydroelectric potential. Could be one of the richest countries in the world, and the people are starving, and they don't have shoes, they don't have schools. Why? Because the transnational capital that comes in, if I'm a big corporation going into the Congo, I'm not going in to leave more money than I take out. I'm going to take out more money than I leave behind, right? They go in and they invest X and they want to take out X prime or X squared or X cubed or whatever. And what you see then is the places that were blessed by the Creator, however you envision the Creator, science, nature, God, Buddha, whatever, the places that were endowed with the greatest natural resources have the most suffering and the most environmental destruction. Look at South Africa, half the world's gold. What did it produce? Apartheid. Because the Anglo-American corporation and other foreign investors didn't care about the development of the African people. In fact, gold mining is very expensive, and the only place they could save money was on keeping labor cheap. That's capital's term. It's not cheap for the workers who have to work for low wages. And so they set up this system of labor control known as apartheid, where black people couldn't be citizens, they couldn't vote, they couldn't live where they wanted to, they couldn't marry who they wanted to, etc., etc. Look at Nigeria. Where's the oil? The Niger River Delta. Where's the most suffering and environmental destruction? Niger River Delta. You don't have to go outside the U.S. Go to Appalachia, that part of the eastern United States, eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, that was blessed with some of the largest bituminous coal deposits in the world, and you have some of the worst poverty rates in the United States because those corporations did not come in to leave wealth. They came in to extract wealth. So the economic prescriptions of the World Bank and the IMF and the U.S. government, et cetera, say you need to do an export economy. The X is right, but it's extractive economy. That's what they're into, extractive. So what's the answer to that? The answer to a colonial economy, which looks like this, you got agriculture, industry, retail, services, whatever. A colonial economy is like this. The connections are out, right? A developed economy has dense internal networks where this factory is producing equipment for this farm is producing products for this factory, this is, and you've got a lot of dense local connections. That is the answer to colonialism. Whether it's Walmart coming into Olympia and knocking out the small business sector or corporations going into South Africa, Nigeria, Bolivia, wherever. And what's going on around the world, this is mostly what I want to talk about, is people waking up to this and building this. Networked local economies that then link up with people in other countries to create what we might call people's globalization or democratic globalization. And this would involve the corporate accountability movement that managed to force the tobacco companies to spit out hundreds of billions of dollars in penalties for their... It's a weird product, tobacco. It's the only product I know of that, if used correctly, kills you. You know, if you use it as it's intended to be used, it kills you. Is there another product? I mean, a gun, you have to misuse it for it to kill you. You know, tobacco, it's like weird product. But it's legal because the tobacco companies were smart enough that when the 1914 Food and Drug Act was passed, they made sure that tobacco was classified not as a food and not as a drug, so it fell outside the law and outside the regulatory apparatus. The sweatshop movement, the anti-sweatshop movement, right? Forced changes in Nike and the Gap and all these different... Now, granted, those companies are still there. They're still doing bad things. But in the process, we developed things like the brand attack, right? We learned how... A brand is something like the Nike swoosh or whatever that a certain meaning is ascribed to. And the rich white guy who's golfing on the golf course wearing a Nike shirt ascribes a different meaning to Nike than the young black guys in the Bronx playing basketball. And what the movement learned is that if you can ascribe different meanings to a brand, well, then we can ascribe a meaning to it like sweatshops. Right? And all of a sudden, Nike became synonymous with sweatshops. You had AP wire photos of young African-American kids at a New York demonstration throwing their Nikes at the front of a Nike Town store at a grand opening. And that AP wire photo goes out. That photo negates millions of dollars worth of advertising. When the Nike Town opened in San Francisco, I got an op-ed in the Chronicle that day, which is our main newspaper, horrible newspaper, but anyway, trashing Nike about the facts of what they pay their workers, etc. They had their press conference at 10 a.m. So we did our press conference at 9 a.m. right in front of the store and prepped all the media. So when the media went into their press conference, the first questions were, what about these sweatshops in China? And Jerry Rice and these other athletes are going, hey, what the hell you mean? I didn't come here to get sandbagged with these tough questions. This is supposed to be softball here. Yeah? And one thing you don't do with the press is start yelling at them and trashing them. Oh. So what I want to, that's one piece, the corporate accountability movement. The other piece of this movement that is very significant, has been growing increasingly potent, is what the media calls the anti-globalization movement, what we call the global justice movement, or the people's globalization movement, or what have you, positive connotation, not anti. You know, you're anti. And, you know, they always focus on the minority of the protesters who break windows or something like that. You know, that gets all the media folks. See, they're a bunch of rabble. You know, they're undisciplined. No, in fact, we're very disciplined. We train for these things. We prepare for them. The WTO meetings in Cancun, we had 7 of our staff people down there, and a lot of other groups had their staff people down there. We sent 4 staff down there, including 2 Mexican staff, months, like about 5 or 6 months ahead of time, and set up an office, Puente a Cancun, Bridge to Cancun, that was there to help integrate the international protesters with the Mexican grassroots groups so that we could shut down those meetings. And in fact, those meetings collapsed. Twice now, WTO World Trade Ministers meetings have been collapsed by mass opposition. Once in Seattle in 99. That's a major achievement, right? That had never, until November 30th, 1999, there had never been a World Trade Ministers meeting stopped by the citizens. That had never happened before. Yeah, people protest and all. And I remember the meetings we had when we found out it was going to be Seattle. Right away, we started saying, let's not just protest. Let's stop them. Let's shut them down. Let's put enough asses out on the asphalt that they can't have their meeting. So now they have to go to places like Cancun, where if you know Cancun, it's this little strip of land with one little road, and you block it here, you block it there, and they think, okay, we got it now. But what they didn't count on was 3 things. The unity within the protest movement, so that the people on the inside, because some of us were registered with the UN as NGOs, we can get into the meetings, and the people on the outside are the same team. Different tactical fronts, but we're on the same team. Just as a military has air power, naval power, mechanized, infantry, etc., but it's unified by a command and control strategy, the movement now is getting beyond what I call tactical sectarianism. I do protests. I write letters to Congress. I do, you know, and instead of us going, oh, you shouldn't do those protests. That's, oh, that writing letters to Congress, that's a waste of time. No, we need all of this stuff, but it needs to be coordinated. Fingers are breakable. Fist, when they come together. So it's unity of diversity. And the environmental movement plays a big role in this because we see that's a basic principle of nature. Unity of diversity. So now in our meetings, we're not so much focused on, oh, well, you're a white male and I'm a black feminist and you're a... Those are our differences. Let's focus on the Venn diagram where we overlap. The stuff we disagree about, we can do that in the bar later over beer and pizza, okay? We can struggle around those things, but if the planet is being destroyed, if the physical basis of human civilization is, and it is being destroyed, I don't have to tell you guys this, you know this, every biological system on the face of the Earth is in a state of collapse, whether it's groundwater, topsoil, depletion of resources, the destruction of species. You know what the second biggest cause of destruction of species is? The first being habitat destruction. The second is international trade. International trade. Because invasive species ride on the trade. They come into a place where there's no predators and they proliferate. Zebra mussels, kudzu vine, Africanized bees, etc. So all this talk about free trade. Yeah, free trade. Yeah, you know what free trade means? Free trade means that when McDonald's wants to lure children into their place, and there's a new Batman movie. They make an agreement with the company that produces the Batman movie to have little Batman and Robin dolls made in sweatshops in China that are put on ships, and they burn dead dinosaurs to fuel that ship and bring it across the ocean to use it as bait in the store to mobilize what McDonald's in its own internal literature calls pester power, to get the kids to bring their parents in to eat food that you shouldn't eat anyway, and 2 weeks later, those little pieces of plastic are going to be in the landfill as garbage. That's a rational system? No, that's not a rational system. That's a system where people who can make money off of that do it for that reason, and they don't care about the rest. If an individual grew up with the same behavioral patterns of the transnational corporation, they'd be in jail. They'd be considered delinquents, sociopaths, right? Because there are no boundaries. All you got to do is just worry about yourself. What happens to a cell in the human body that becomes irresponsible regarding the cells around it? It's called a metastasizing tumor, right? It's the cancer cell. It's the ideology of the cancer cell. Grow, 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 grow. No limits to grow. Grow, grow, grow. Anything near you, screw it. Trees in the way, cut them down. Fish in the way, kill them. People in the way, move them out. Knock their homes down. That's the ideology of the cancer cell. Unlimited growth. And that's the ideology that has been pumped out into the population. Free market. Free. And it's not, you know, it sounds like free love, free sex, free lunch, you know, free. It sounds good. But it's not free. It's coming at a great cost. At great, the cost of greater inequality, greater environmental destruction, and the third and possibly worst part, a moral, spiritual crisis where those of us who live in here, right, who have college education, and if you have college education, you're privileged. I don't care what family background you, I come from an extremely poor family, but I got a PhD. So I got options, and I know what those options are. I can bail out on this political stuff anytime I want, right, and, you know, sell out and make a big paycheck. So the choice for these people is, are you going to work for the elite globalization, or are you going to work for people's globalization? And everybody knows damn well, you work for this globalization, one, you're going to make less money, and two, it could jeopardize your career. Could even jeopardize you physically, perhaps, if you're of the scared type. Personally, I come from the school that knows that social roles always come in pairs. For the intimidator to exist, it requires someone willing to play the role of intimidatee. And if you refuse to be intimidated, if your attitude is, put the handcuffs on me, I dare you, you'll so regret it. Go ahead. That's the only attitude you can take. Because you remember the quote from Reverend Niemöller in Germany in World War II. He said, when they came for the Jews, I was not a Jew, so I didn't stand up and resist. When they came for the communists, I was not a communist. When they came for the labor union, and then he concludes it by saying, when they finally came for me, there was nobody to stand up for me. So the reverse of that is, come to my house first. I dare you. Come knock on my door. You come. You try and get global exchange. You know, people say, aren't you worried about your organization being repressed? Why would I waste a nanosecond? They're going to tap the phones. Yeah, tap the phones. It means people have to be careful about what they say on the phone. So, I mean, you should do that anyway, right? Just be careful about what you say. So what I want to focus on is, what is our response to this triple crisis, and what are the early stages of the next economy that we can already see? Diverse movements around the world are coming together to replace this set of values, which is money values, willing to use violence, with life values. This is corporate profits, this is human rights and the environment. This is embodied in things like the World Trade Organization, tens of thousands of pages of how capital can move around the planet and rip off resources, etc. And this has a nice concise summary in the Earth Charter. If you haven't read the Earth Charter, read the Earth Charter. It's earthcharter.org. You can find it. Brilliant document that brings together the insights of the human rights accords and the multilateral environmental agreements. So the basic choice confronting the planet is, should commerce, money values, rule over life, or, as we would say, no, life should rule over commerce. And you can test this very easily. Go out on the street and say to people, which is sacred, life or commerce? Everybody knows life is sacred. Commerce is just an activity. It's a necessary activity, but it's like religion or sport or entertainment. It's an activity. It's not sacred. Life is sacred. And the cycle of life is being chewed up, eaten, cancerized by the money cycle. There's a book, it's called The Cancer Stage of Capitalism by a Canadian academic, and he lays this all out in great detail. I recommend it. I forget the guy's name, but I'll remember it later when it's irrelevant. So let me just touch on unpacking this rope here, the strands of this rope. You got fair trade organizations that assist third world grassroots groups, plus educate consumers in the U.S. When we get people coming into our stores and they pick up some nice little soapstone candle holder and it was made by a handicapped group in Kenya, they can see a picture, they can hear about what they're doing, and it humanizes the commodity, right? Which is one of the ways in which our system is dehumanized. I want to know who made this glass. Where'd this glass come from? Where'd the water come from? We should know these things. So fair trade organizations are involved in international trade not to get rich themselves, but to, one, change the inequality in the world and help educate people here so that they will go out and strengthen this and weaken this. All politics reduces to the bumper sticker, unite friends, divide adversaries. Unite friends, divide adversaries. So in any particular struggle, you want to be looking at who are our friends, and you draw that circle as big as you can, and who are the adversaries, and we want to drive wedges into their ranks. And you can do that. We did it in the anti-apartheid movement, right? Because these corporate links to the white minority in South Africa, the divestment movement, the selective purchase movement, went to city governments and passed laws saying the city of San Francisco will not do any business with any corporation that is invested in South Africa. Motorola looks at its balance sheet globally and realizes less than 1% of their money comes from South Africa and 30% comes from selling radios to police stations and fire stations in the U.S., and they bail out of South Africa. And no less an authority than Nelson Mandela himself said that was one of the key, obviously the main element was the uprising by the South African people, but a key element was weakening this elite. When they see their investments getting cut off, rich white guys freak out when the money starts to get turned off because they're used to living high on the hog, right? So you got the fair trade organizations. You got fair trade labeling. You can now go into a store. And by the way, these are our websites, globalexchange.org, Green Festivals. This is for the Green Festivals we do, which is a huge green economy expo, 250 green economy exhibits and about 40 or 50 speakers and live music and food and beer and wine, all organic, so that people can come in. The one in San Francisco in November, we had 19,500 people come through the door. And they get to see how we're supposed to be, the ant pile. You know, we're an ant pile. Humans are social creatures. We're like wolves and ants. We're supposed to be together in groups. If you're not, if you're isolated, there's really good mental health data on this now. People who are socially active, whether it's church, civic groups, politics, whatever, have more mental health generally than people who are isolated and not part of networks. So it's in your own self-interest to be active and be socially active. Greenmart.us is a building we're doing. I'll talk about this a little bit more. It's the permanent green economy store because green festivals, people kept coming up to me saying, oh, Kevin, this is so cool, man. How often can you do this? The answer is every day, right? Greenmart. It's not Walmart. It's Greenmart. So that if you want organic sheets and pillowcases or beeswax candles or wind energy or whatever you want, that all exists right now. And all it needs is somebody to create a space where those small companies can afford to be in a main downtown location. But the idea of Green Mart is we'll do a building where these offices up here are going to be the nonprofit groups like Mother Jones, Global Exchange, etc. We will market in our emails, newsletter, website, etc. We'll market this address and tell people, hey, come to this address. And the Green Mart, Green Everything store on the ground floor, its profits go back into the building. virtuous circle, so that these nonprofit groups understand if this ground floor retail succeeds, your rent goes down. So they have a self-interest in making it succeed. Now, granted, it's complicated when you're doing a $40 million building. Yeah, that's tough. You got to find where you're going to get. But there's actually people who know how to do that. The science of it has now developed where you got the Social Enterprise Alliance. You've got people that come from a corporate background who are getting radicalized by the environmental crisis. And you've got lefties who are starting to realize, you know, enterprise can be a useful tool as long as we have rules set up like Global Exchange. We're a nonprofit, so nobody owns it. Nobody can buy it. You know, Coca-Cola can't come in and take it over. I'd love to see them try. It would be great. When we set up the Green Mart website, you know, Walmart has a five-sided star in between the wall and the mart. So we put a five-sided flower in between the green and the mart, hoping maybe they'll sue us, you know. It'd be great publicity. They're probably not that stupid. You see how now Walmart has these ads with their featuring their associates. They're not workers, you guys. They're associates. What a wonderful company. And I wonder why they started doing that. Is because they got hundreds of lawsuits. There's 30 states where they have lawsuits. There are over 300 vacant Walmart buildings that they've left behind. There are hundreds of places where they've been stopped, right? There was a place down in Arizona where one of the issues that they stopped them on was night sky. And I said, night sky? What the hell are you talking about? Because when you build a big parking lot with those big lights, it takes away night sky, right? And that's not a left-wing issue. That cuts across. A lot of right-wingers like to look at the night sky, too. You know, they're not all morons. So now you have fair trade labeling. Most of you probably know that there's a fair trade certified. It's a little stick figure holding scales of justice, and it says fair trade certified on it. If you buy your coffee beans or your chocolate or your tea and now bananas and mangoes in Europe, they're even up to soccer balls. If you buy products with the fair trade certified label on it, you are ensuring, in the case of coffee, for example, the coffee farmer is going to get $1.40 a pound for organic beans. The market price is probably about 40 cents that they're getting. Right, because what happens is that's world market price, but the actual price the farmers get goes down as low as 7 cents. There are places in Central America where farmers... This is coffee that's selling for like $13 a pound at Starbucks, whatever, right? And the farmers are getting as low as 7 cents a pound. Why? Because a small farmer is out in the mountains. The guy with the truck comes out and says, I'll give you 40 cents a pound. The guy says, oh, wait a minute. I heard on the radio that it was selling for 50 cents a pound. The guy says, well, screw you. Sell it to the radio then. I'm here with the truck. Do you want to sell your stuff or not? It all comes on to harvest at the same time, because that's the way nature works. So the small farmer is at a disadvantage to this whole corporate system. But now the progressive mind says, wait a minute. We can go direct. We can cut out all this corporate stuff, and we go direct. Think of the principle behind community-supported agriculture. You get a few dozen families that go directly to the farmer and say, okay, we've met and we need 300 pounds of carrots, 400 pounds of potatoes, 500 pounds of onions, blah, 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 blah. Here's our produce needs for the year. Will you, the farmer, grow this organically and have a relationship with us? You will know harvest price at planting time. What? That's unheard of, because you're cutting the market out of it. Hmm? So if you have any doubts about cutting the market out of a relationship, what I always say when I'm doing right-wing radio, I say, you know, there's a socialist institution in every community in this country. And they, what? What are you talking about, socialist institution? But it's called the public library. Because there's no market relationship between you and the books. Because 100 years ago, Andrew Carnegie and a lot of other rich people decided books were so important to have an educated working class that you had to give free access to everyone to books. And I agree, books are important. But what about healthcare? What about housing? What about transit, energy? These things are basic necessities that are as important as books. And there should be a library version. Well, if you go to Cuba or France, Germany, Sweden, Denmark, a lot of other countries, they do have a public library version of those things, right? Restrictions on how much a landlord can charge, free access to health care, free daycare. Why don't we have a national daycare system in the United States? Is that a joke or what? You go to Cuba and there are these daycares all over the place, totally affordable. They've got a doctor and a nurse on the staff in each one, a big tracking system with the kids' names, and, you know, are they walking and talking and going potty and all this kind of stuff so they know that the kids are developing right and all this attention. Well, that just makes total sense. I don't care what your politics, what's the most important resource we have? It's our children. Because they're the ones who, when we're old and frail, do we want them to be good citizens or outlaws? Duh. You know, and you guys got to start thinking about that, because within the next 10 years or so, you're going to start having kids and you're going to go, do I really want to bring a child into this world? Yes, you do. The answer is yes, you do. I have two girls and it's the best thing that ever happened to me. And yes, it takes a lot of energy, and yes, you can get your heart broken, but that's true of all kinds of love. You can get your heart broken. You know, there's a risk involved, and that's what makes it so exciting. There are now ways in which you can buy things like wood that has an eco label on it. And this is expanding into other products so that it empowers the customer to know, okay, this wood was not sustainably harvested. This wood over here was. And that allows the consumer to affect production. And I think where we're going with this labeling, what I'm pushing in the movement is full content labeling. That is, you'll have a label on every product, and it'll be a biography that'll tell the social impact and the environmental impact of that product. What did the workers get paid? Where did it come from? What happens when it's dead? Does it get recycled? Is it part of the landfill? The whole story. Full content labeling. And we could have it on everything. It could be on this podium, this stuff. And that's something you can do. Right? You don't need permission. You don't need to wait for legislation for that. You can do as a research project, where did this slate come from? And then you print up nice little labels and you go around and you stick them on all the blackboards or the lecterns or whatever the item is that you choose. This is something you can do. You don't need permission. But a professor, if we have any professors in the crowd, you could do it as a class and, you know, have groups go out and say, pick a commodity and write a full content label of it. And think, we already have that for food. You have nutrition labeling. When I was a kid, there wasn't nutrition labeling. People had to fight for that. Right? And then at the resistance of the companies, we got nutrition labeling, and that's being refined. In 2006, we'll get trans fats, we'll be in there. And the law says it's the company has to do that. You put it on them. It's not on us. They have to pay for it. Because after all, we need to know what's in there, right? And that's going to be a continuing struggle. You have thousands of micro enterprise lending groups. Over 2,000 groups now take small amounts of capital, put them in the hands of people at the grassroots. Usually gets paid, it's mostly women, usually it gets paid back in a group so that there's solidarity if one of the group has trouble paying it back. Woman gets money to buy a cow, she can sell milk on a street corner, or money to buy tools and whatever. And, you know, some leftist friends of mine critique this stuff by saying, oh, it's just junior capitalism and it's debt. No. Yeah, well, that's easy for you to say, ensconced in your nice loft in Manhattan, sitting at your computer. But for people whose children are crying at night, mommy, I'm hungry, daddy, I'm hungry, it's a big deal to be able to work your way out of poverty and not be dependent on charity. Charity sucks, okay? Charity is a nice instinct by those of us who are wealthy enough to write a check to Oxfam or whatever, but it sucks being on the recipient end of being dependent. And I know, as somebody who has to go out and beg to foundations, I really don't like begging. It's necessary for the work I do, but we're always trying at Global Exchange to reduce the percentage of our budget that's from begging. And I'm proud to say less than 10% of our total money is foundation money. 2/3 of our money is enterprise, where we're providing some kind of goods or services that people want and they're willing to pay for it. It's totally voluntary. The membership stuff is the begging. So remember what I said earlier about the membership. So micro-enterprise lending. Jim Hightower, who's going to speak tonight at 7, if you haven't heard him speak, definitely go. If you have heard him speak, he's always entertaining and enjoyable and smart, and a good friend of mine. He says, capital is like horse manure. If you concentrate in a big pile, it stinks. If you spread it out evenly, it makes things grow. And that's what all of these movements are about. Whether they know it or not, whether they state it explicitly or not, it's about the democratization of capital. And for those of you who think this isn't radical enough, Karl Marx talked about control over the means of production, right? And what Marxists have done is talk about control over the means of production. And I say to them, you ever run a store? You ever run a store? Just a little store. You ever run a store? One of the best lines that Arnold Schwarzenegger, who I do not like, said in the campaign was, he said, I'm used to signing checks on the front, because he created employment and he employed people and he was signing checks. When you're responsible for other people's paychecks, our payroll at Global Exchange every 2 weeks is $60,000. That's a heavy burden for the people like me who have to go out and raise that money. And you feel that burden of other people's livelihood is resting on you, right? But that's part of the challenge to us, is not to just take care of me. You know, any idiot can find a job and get by. You know, yeah, okay, I'm just taking care of me. No, take care of about 10 or 20 or 40 or 50 or 800 other people too, and create institutions that can give people work that is meaningful. Not the kind of work where people wake up in the morning and go, oh, shit, I got to go to work. You realize that most people in this country, their greatest act of heroism is putting their feet on the floor in the morning because they hate their jobs, okay? And it's why a lot of you are at an age where you're trying to decide, go for the passion. Forget the money. The money will come. If you do what your passion is about, you'll be good at it. And because you're good at it, people will give you money. Don't buy all this stuff about, oh, you know, all this pressure about, oh, you got to make a lot of money. We got to make a lot of money. Believe me, I've been there. I've done lots of stuff that didn't require a lot of money. Went through some real dry spells of money, but I was happy because I was doing stuff that I really enjoyed, and being involved with people, particularly my work in Africa, people who didn't have a pot to piss in, literally, totally physically poor in terms of material wealth, but very rich in terms of knowing their neighbors, having a community, having self-respect, having dignity, being able to look you in the eye, walking down the street and not having to go like this when somebody says good morning. You ever notice that here? I got people in my neighborhood who you walk down the street and you say good morning and they look down at the cement. It's like the cement didn't say hi to you, it was me. You know? But it's this, oh, we got to be afraid, the terrorists. We are the most powerful country in the world, and the population is walking around scared shit. What is that? That's been created because these people up on top want us to be stupid and fearful, right? It's obvious what they're doing. Socially responsible investing. There are now hundreds of companies that screen investments for social responsibility and environmental responsibility. They now outperform the Dow Jones and the major indicators of these companies that are not screened. The Domini Index is outperforming. There's $2 trillion just in the U.S. alone in those socially and environmentally screened funds. $2 trillion. That's a pretty big chunk of change. There's a whole movement to promote what's called the Tobin tax. This would be a very small, like 0.1% tax on international currency transactions. International currency transactions, which is one of these connections, it's these folks, we're affected by it when the dollar goes down or up or things, but we don't control it, and if there are any international currency speculators in the room, I'd like to talk to you afterwards about our major donor program that you might want to write a check to. In 1 week, this international currency speculation, in 1 week, generates more money than all international trade does in a year. In 1 week. You're talking about $1.5 trillion a day, right? Turns over in these markets. I'm not talking about the derivatives market. That's another $1 to $2 trillion a day. That's just total speculation. Same with currency. It doesn't create anything, right? So people are saying, look, we could put a tiny tax on that. It would generate hundreds of billions of dollars a year, and it could go in small amounts into healthcare, education, infrastructure, you know, water, irrigation, etc., other productive investments. Community-supported agriculture has taken off like a rocket. linking families directly with the farmer, cuts Safeway and all of that out of the middle, more money for the farmer, better deal for the consumer. In San Francisco, they have a thing called The Box. And what it is it's a network of farms, organic farms, that they go out and they get subscribers, just like a magazine subscription. You sign up and you check off the fruits and vegetables that you prefer, and once a week that box shows up on your front step. Fresh produce, grown organically, and it's just like a subscription. There's no corporate middleman involved. It's a direct relationship between networked farmers and networked consumers. And think, the difference between a network where you've got a flat hierarchy of people all linked up together, that's a lot different than these hierarchies. The World Bank, the IMF, the transnational corporation, the Catholic Church, all of these hierarchies with all these levels of command and control, they're all in crisis. They're all in crisis. There's a book called Networks and Net Wars. It was done by the Rand Corporation for the Pentagon. And these guys study the protests in Seattle and all these different networks, and they conclude that networks are superior in many ways to a hierarchy. A hierarchy is very slow, it's very cumbersome. You got to get permission, command goes up and down, there's all these, you know, levels of misunderstanding. Whereas a network, you can connect people much more directly. And now we have the technology that makes this network possible on a global level. Once the software and the hardware gets redistributed around the world to the grassroots, we did a project at Global Exchange when the first democratic election happened in South Africa. Our friends in the African National Congress in South Africa, Mandela's group, came to us and said, we need computers. So we went to law firms. Dan, you know about this. Law firms get new computers all the time. So we go to the law firms and we say, look, donate your computers to us, your old ones. We'll pack them up, take them down to South Africa. You get the tax write-off. They get the computers, and we just have to raise the money for the shipping, right? There are some countries in Europe, Sweden, Denmark, etc., where the government pays the shipping, and they encourage citizen groups to collect stuff like that and transfer it to people here. And it does two things. It transfers the equipment, but it creates a linkage between people. And now, with software and hardware being what it is, we have the possibility of global voting. We can now vote on big issues like, should we save the environment or destroy it? Should there be gender equity on a planetary level? You know what percentage of global property is owned by women?
Half.
Yeah, it's like 1%, according to UN data. Who decided that? I mean, it should be at least 50%. I'd say make it 60 or 70, right? I mean, you could go out on the street in the United States and pick 535 women at random and put them in the House and the Senate in Washington, D.C. and get better policies. Don't you think? I mean, really. And I don't say that as a joke. I think that's worthy of a scientific test. Try it for a year. If you go back and you look at the budget proposals that have been put forward for decades by the Congressional Black Caucus, if those had been implemented, we'd be in a lot better shape now. We wouldn't have a $7 trillion federal debt. You realize the federal debt, the federal government debt of the United States, our government, is three times the size of all third world government debt combined. And these gooks from Washington are going around to third world countries, hey, you're in debt. You should tighten your belt and cut your social services. It gives hypocrisy a bad name, you know? I mean, people in third world countries saying, who the hell are these guys coming telling us that we're in debt and we should tighten our belt when your government has three times the debt of all third world governments combined? It's ridiculous on the face of it. But notice most people in this country don't know the details of it, but they're going to find out eventually. You have alternative communities like Gaviotas in Colombia, Kerala in India. The province of Kerala in India has twice the population density of the rest of India, and it has first world social statistics like infant mortality, maternal mortality, female literacy. That's the one indicator. Female literacy is the best indicator. If you want to change something that's going to have a huge ripple effect on all your other social indicators, female literacy. If you're going to invest in one thing that's going to have huge development effects, female literacy is the one thing that you'll have the biggest effect on. And you can look at the data. It's very clear. It shows up in the data, that correlation. Porto Alegre in Brazil, where they do participatory budgeting, where they go to neighborhoods and say, okay, we've got this amount of money in your neighborhood. Do you want to use it for a library, for a school, for new roads, for mass transit, whatever? And there's participation of the public. When was the last time you saw a town in the United States where there was participation by the public in the budgetary process? Most people don't even know when the meetings happen. And there are some exceptions. There are some towns. I'm sure some of you have been to places or maybe grew up in a small town. I can remember in the small town I grew up in that we'd have town hall meetings where people would debate, public disagreement and discussion. Wow, what a unique concept, instead of sitting in front of the TV being bombarded with ads, right? Alternative models of ownership are taking off. Co-ops, employee stock ownership plans. In the United States, 6.5% of the U.S. economy is nonprofit enterprises. We have 47,000 cooperatives in the United States, 2,500 worker-owned businesses, et cetera, et cetera. There's also changes going on within the trade union movement, where the trade union movement is starting to realize that because the corporate adversary is transnational, the workers' movement has to also be transnational. So the labor movement is starting, and I stress starting, it's in the early stages, of breaking out of this nationalistic, well, as long as we in the U.S. think of this contradiction. The very section of U.S., of the U.S. economy that was most amenable to accepting trade unions was the big monopoly sector, autos, steel, rubber, tires, glass, etc. Those are also the same corporate sectors that have been moving out of the country and that can most easily move out to other countries. So there's a real crisis within the trade union movement of membership going down. The section of the trade union movement that's been growing is the service sector, AFSCME, SEIU, etc. And now we're seeing a lot of those jobs starting to be sent offshore, because anything that can be digitized, anything that can be put on fiber optic cable, you know, data, that's gone, because an X-ray technician or a software engineer in India is going to cost you maybe a fifth or a sixth of what somebody in Silicon Valley is going to cost you. The trade union movement is also realizing, at least the progressive elements are realizing, that a shop floor focus of just our members and screw the rest of the community, that's not going to work anymore. And increasingly you see unions reaching out. We have the steel workers coming to Global Exchange saying, hey, can we collaborate on something? If you guys want to be part of our health care plan, we have a good health care plan. And then when we're doing a strike, will you turn out protesters for, you know, and we can collaborate. That didn't happen 15, 20 years ago. Trade unions are also realizing that their pension funds, which are now in the trillions of dollars, could be a very powerful force if they're mobilized and focused. There is a huge local economy movement. Check out, there's a great website called New Rules, newrules.org. New Rules is done by a thing called the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Great group. I think they have offices in D.C. But New Rules documents how in so many communities around the country, people are changing local laws to keep wealth in the local community. Right? And I would argue that this local green economy movement, I'd love to have a debate with other leftists sometime who think this isn't true or they want to argue against it. I would argue that the local green economy is our strongest weapon against empire. Because transnational corporations, if you're talking about local and green, transnational corporations are not local. They're translocal. They're not rooted in place. That's their economic muscle. They can pick up and move anytime they want, but that's their political Achilles heel, because we can go out to the local community and say, Walmart doesn't care about this community. That's propaganda. They come in here and they wreck the small business sector. So on this local issue, you can mobilize the local chamber of commerce, because they know they're getting screwed, the independent bookstores, the mom-and-pop stores, the family farmers. And green, because The big corporations, they don't care about the environment. I mean, that's rhetoric. That's in their budget for propaganda. A tree standing has no value to them. It's only when they kill the tree. A fish swimming alive, it has no value. It's only when you kill the fish and turn it into a marketable commodity. Well, that's their Achilles heel as well, because we can go out to the public and educate them about the environmental crisis and say, you know what? For every one of these products that they produce in a non-sustainable way, there is now an ecological alternative. When we do the Green Festival, people have cups in their hands that they think are plastic cups. They're not plastic. They look like plastic, but they're totally biodegradable. They're compostable. They go right into the ground. They go into the landfill, or they go actually into compost pits. Plastic forks, plastic spoons, all of that stuff. Now, those things might cost you more, like an unbleached coffee filter costs you more. And I don't understand that, because if you're not using bleach, that's one less ingredient. It should cost less, right? But the glass half full analysis of that says, yeah, it costs more because it's more valuable. Organic agriculture has been growing at 20% a year for the past 10 years. And as the soil gets destroyed, the value of organic agriculture is going to continue to go up. Think about this. When the petroleum starts to run out in 30, 40, 50 years, whatever, the numbers don't really matter. When the petroleum starts to run out, what happens to this industrial agriculture model? Because the tractors run on petroleum, the fertilizer, the pesticide, it's all petroleum derived, right? You're talking about running up against a wall at 80 miles an hour. But it's not going to be a sudden impact. It's going to be the price of oil go up, up, up. And then that makes alternatives more competitive on a market basis. If you look at wind energy right now, the cost per kilowatt hour is going like this, and coal is going like this, and we're right here. They're crossing. And coal is going up, as are all the other fuels. Nuclear power wouldn't exist if it weren't for government subsidies. What killed nuclear power was capitalism, because it's not profitable. The only way they survive, these companies, is by sucking our tax money out of government, by bribing our politicians with huge campaign contributions, and by lobbying the hell out of them. Nuclear power wouldn't even exist. Yucca Mountain in Nevada, they've spent over $5 billion on that thing. The engineers who are working on it are bailing on the project saying, this is not workable. These are the engineers who got paid to work on it. The people in Nevada don't want it. And that's supposed to take the nuclear waste from all around? This is totally unsustainable. And it's getting more and more difficult for the corporations to hide these facts from the public. That's why there's all this bombardment of the Super Bowl and reality TV and the child, you know, whatever, the survival, all these stupid, Janet Jackson's breast. What about the guy who ripped their dress? You know, what about that? You know, I mean, did you dig that? That all the talk was about her. What about the guy that ripped her dress open? It seems like he should be the one that's really the focus of attention. And obviously the whole thing was manipulated anyway. She has a new album out. That's just a coincidence, you know. So one of the things that we're promoting at Global Exchange is what we're calling Buy Local Month. This will be from Thanksgiving to Christmas. It's when retail companies make 40% of their annual revenue. Right? It's the big shopping season. It's not saying you can't shop. It's saying, and of course we want people to shop less. You know, we consume way too much in this country. But it's saying go out and figure out who are the locally owned, right? And what people are doing in more progressive places, people are saying, let's find stuff that's not only locally owned, but also locally produced, and also organic, and also, you know, locally. I have some friends that are working on a smart card, where groups like Global Exchange and all these groups have come together and all use the same smart card, and will say, if you buy from locally owned, that's 1 point. If you, because there's credits you get, like reward bonus points. If you buy locally owned and locally produced, that's 2. If it's locally owned, locally produced, and ecological, that's 3, you know. And you sort of nudge people, because not everybody's going to get radical just like this. You got to go easy with some people, right? I want to get the Republican businessmen on our side. I want the veterans, the truck drivers. When I do right-wing radio, the best call is, guy calls in and says, well, this guy Danaher sounds like a communist, but I agree. These corporations are really screwing us. But I'm saying to these guys, hey, we got a World Bank protest coming up in a few. You should come out to it, man. You know, bring your truck. Because in Seattle, in the Seattle WTO protest, there was one intersection where there was a whole bunch of global exchange people, and there was a huge Teamsters truck that had water and a sound system and all this kind of stuff. Cops did not mess with people at that intersection. It's funny how that works, you know? When they were up against steel workers, dock workers, truck drivers, etc., who these big barrel-chested types, there wasn't any big fight. It's one thing to pick on us little hippie kids, you know, because, you know, we're just going to take it. These guys, they've cut off their thumbs with chainsaws and had truck accidents, you know, pinned in the wreckage of a truck. And so you're not going to scare them with boo. They go, boo, what's that? You know? And I saw some confrontations like that where some of these working class trade union guys were standing real close to the cops, talking to them real nice right in their face. If you penetrate somebody's personal space and they're in a position of authority, it kind of messes with their psychology a little bit. You know, saying, what is this? I pay your salary, dude. You know, you're a public servant. Go get me a drink of water, you know? So there's an attitudinal shift, and in some ways Bush has helped this. People are starting to understand that our system of government was founded on the principle that sovereignty, which comes from the Latin word for king, make sure I get it right, sovereignty comes from rex, regis, it means ultimate political power, ultimate political authority. And our system was the first nation state that established the principle that sovereignty does not reside in government. It does not reside in the courts or the Congress or the White House. It resides in we the people. And that's why our Constitution, our founding document, starts with those magic words, we the people. And granted, a lot of the insights that Washington and Ben Franklin people got, they got from Native Americans, who they proceeded then to destroy. But the principle was established in law that we rule. And that's what democracy means. It comes from two Greek roots, demos, which means people, and kratos, which means rule. People rule. And republic, we're a democratic republic. Republic comes from two Latin words, res meaning thing, and publica meaning of the people. A thing of the people where the people rule. Do the people rule? Half the people don't even vote. Right? This is a crisis of huge historic proportions, and we got to make sure we fix that. It's on us, right? It's our responsibility. So what we're doing, what my work is the Green Festival, creating a platform where the for-profit green economy companies and the non-profit radical groups can come together. We have everything from Earth First to Toyota in the same place. And they play nice together. And the reason Toyota is the only car company we went to, because Toyota made an announcement a year ago that they were going to transition all their drivetrains by 2012 to some kind of hybrid, hydrogen fuel cell, electric, some kind of alternative engine. So we went to them and we said, do you want to be corporate pioneer? You know, pat them on the head. And what we want to do with the building is make that permanent, to have a central location near a BART station, near the subway, where we get tourists and local traffic. We do events, all of us groups, Mother Jones, Global Exchange, etc. We're doing events all the time. We've got to look for a university lecture hall, a union hall, a church. Here, we'll have our own building. And you do the events downstairs in the food court area. So picture a big, like a department store, a mall kind of thing. And you come in and there's maybe a fair trade cafe, there's third world crafts, there's renewable energy, there's home care products, seventh generation, you know, these kind of companies who we work with anyway from the Green Festival. And deep in the place is your food court area. And we're thinking maybe like a soup, salad, sandwich, juice bar, good Vietnamese restaurant, nice taqueria, all organic, really clean and everything. Big seating area that in the evening you move the tables aside and you have Jim Hightower, you have a dance. You have events where you bring in the hip-hop kids and the elders on the same night so they get to know each other. We have a workout room that'll have stationary bicycles and rowing machines that generate electricity. Right? Put bird-friendly wind energy on the roof. You try and generate all your electricity for the entire building from your own structure, your own design in the building. All of that green technology exists. That's off-the-shelf technology now. It's just a question of putting it together in the same place. Let me end with this. The worst thing that we have confronting us is not Bush and it's not the corporations. It's our own sense of powerlessness. It's that little voice inside that says, oh, we can't really do this, can we? I'm only one person. What can I... Really? You're only one person? I'm eight people. Nice to meet you. You know, what? Why do people say that? You know, I'm only... Oh, Kevin, I agree with you, but I'm only one person. What can I do? You're only one person. That's rough. We're all only one person, okay? That's not a statement of stupidity. It's an expression of powerlessness. It's looking for the side door out of responsibility. Right? You know, because we live in the empire, we benefit materially, we benefit. We're in here. We're benefiting from this transfer of resources upward in the global class structure. But we want to be moral. Everybody wants to have a good self-image of themselves. So we say, I'm against imperialism. It's easy to denounce evil and injustice. Unless you're actually doing something, unless you're risking something, it's just like in a relationship, unless you're willing to risk and open yourself up to being vulnerable, you're not really committed to it, right? I know this as a guy. We have a problem with that commitment stuff, you know. This is true confessions. But we as a people in this country have to realize our historic task, the responsibility confronting us is we have to make a transition from being an empire to being just a nation in a community of nations, a good neighbor. And the biggest obstacle we face is that voice inside us that says, well, cynicism, right? The intellectual coward. Cynicism is what passes for insight when courage is lacking. And you find it on the college campuses. No offense to any of you who are students here, but I do a lot of lecturing on college campuses, and the cynicism, you know, it's like that question, are you apathetic, ignorant, or ambivalent? I don't know. I don't care either way. You know? And you literally hear it. I don't know. I don't care either way. You know? And cynicism, actually, it comes from a Greek word meaning like a dog. No offense to dogs, but I mean, you know, come on. The way they introduce themselves to each other, that sniffing stuff. Whoa, geez, you know, please. I don't know. Maybe I should try it sometime. I don't know. So you hear people saying all this stuff, you can't fight City Hall. You'll never hear a rich developer say you can't fight City Hall. They fight City Hall all the time. They say, Secretary, get me the mayor on the phone. Hey, mayor, I gave you $10,000 in the last election. You're holding up my condos. What the hell's going on? They don't say, oh, you can't fight City Hall. Or people say, oh, if you have a revolution, the new revolutionaries will be just as bad as the... Okay, so let's just give up then. You know, let's just be a bunch of whimpering slobs who say, oh, no, we can't change anything. If our ancestors took that position, we'd all be talking like this, right? We'd be a colony of England. There'd still be slavery. Women wouldn't have the right to vote. We'd be living in caves, grunting at each other, rubbing sticks together, etc. And granted, there are problems with so-called technological progress. But history is replete with stories of human beings seeing an obstacle, and some of them going, it's a wall, and others going, that's a hurdle, and going over it to the next stage of human development. So imagine that. I use this when I talk to people who are really resistant to being activists and they're really cynical, people who don't realize that you can't spell education without A-C-T-I-O-N. You know, if you want to know an apple, if you really want to know it, you can read every book in the world, but you got to bite into it to really know it. When you bite into it, you transform it. It's not the same anymore. And social reality is the same way. So what I say to these people is, imagine you're away from home and your loved ones, your children, your mom, your grandpa, whatever, are in your house, and the house is on fire. And they're stuck in an upstairs room, and they're screaming out the window for help. And there's only one person walking down the street within earshot. Do you want that person to be a cynic or an activist? You want that person to be an activist because it's your loved one. Well, isn't every human being on the face of the earth one of our loved ones, part of our family? Isn't every child one of my children? My children aren't the two girls who I write checks for, you know, who live in my house. My children are all the children on the face of the earth. I think that's the only correct spiritual approach to these kinds of issues. And if we really feel that Julian Beck, the playwright, says we are a feelingless people. If we could really feel the suffering and injustice in the world, we would run out into the streets and end the war, end prisons, end suffering, end injustice. We would just do it. And we have the ability to instill that kind of motivation in other people. That is within all of our realm of abilities. We can do that if we can overcome that internalized voice saying, you can't. And we've all had situations. The first time you dive into water, and then after you do it, oh wow, you do it a million times because it's so much fun. Anything you do for the first time is going to seem difficult. Love, romance, sex, all that stuff. It's spooky. But once you do it, you realize, oh wow, yeah. We just had an election in San Francisco where Matt Gonzalez, the Green Party candidate, got over 47% of the vote, right? Now, he didn't become mayor, but you got to remember, the Green Party in San Francisco has 3% of registered voters. So those of us who are party activists, at the evening of the election, when they first projected the TV screen up on the wall, and it showed him with 40-some percent of the vote, and the other guy with 50-some, guys like me are like, yeah! Like, and the young people are going, what the heck? What are you cheering about? Our guy's losing. But 40-some percent? We're used to getting like 8%, 3%, 5%. Something's changing. Gavin Newsom, who, you know, I'll give him a break. He's doing some very interesting things. You know, the guy, he's pretty gutsy. So, you know, all power to him. I hope he succeeds. He had to bring in, the Democratic Party had to bring in Clinton and Gore, former president and vice president. And still, you figure if the Greens have 3% of registered voters, that means 44% of the voters came from the Democratic Party over to vote for the Green candidate, right? That kind of thing is going on in a lot of different places. People changing law, changing who's in power, etc. John Madden, the football commentator, he has a good saying where he says there's three kinds of people in the world. There's the kind of people who make things happen. There's the kind of people who stand on the sidelines watching other people make things happen. And there's people who don't know what's happening. So you got to decide which of those three you want to be. And I think it's pretty easy. And I know I don't have to say that to a lot of you because a lot of you are probably activists already. I just want to encourage you in that direction, and I want to encourage you to try and link up with other people. A lot of this is about networking and learning how to work together, getting the fingers into the fist. And if you don't like that militant analogy, think of piano playing, right? Get everybody to play nice and work together, and we can work out the differences later on. So thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it. Questions, comments, criticisms, speeches with a question mark at the end, trashing, self-trashing. Can I take a bunch so everybody gets a chance here? Yes, sir. Anyone else? Can I do these? I don't see hands. Okay. The last one first. There's a thing that you should all have called the National Green Pages. It's a directory. I keep it on my desk and people call up and ask, is there a recycle carpet company? I say, yeah, just to say, and it makes me sound really smart. And all I'm doing is looking through the National Green Pages. If you go to coopamerica.org, like coopamerica.org, the National Green Pages is about 200 pages thick, and it's got every, whatever the product is you want, there's some alternative company that's producing it. The problem is they tend to be small. So that's why us and Global Exchange and Co-op America do the Green Festival. We bring these companies all in one place so people can come and see, hear, taste, smell the green economy all in one place and go, oh, wow, that's pretty damn convincing, you know. And if we can, we're trying to develop, we get all these requests from Vancouver and Chicago and all these different places saying, when are you going to do a Green Festival here? Well, it's a huge event. It costs a lot of money. These venues... See, in order to do a 100,000 or 125,000 square foot event, that you're talking a massive, like DC, we're doing the new DC Convention Center, Hall C. You'd fit this room like about 50 times into that room. It's massive. A lot of the time, those halls are empty They amortize the cost of that downtime into your 2 days that you're renting it. So it costs about $100,000 just for the space. Not talking about, you know, we got to have a staff of about 11 people to do the production and the design and and we've got some great innovative stuff, like we get full page ads in Mother Jones and Utney and The Nation that we don't pay for. We trade them exposure at the event. They get a booth, they get a table, they get a banner, they get mentioned in all our other ads, etc. And, you know, that's great, but you still got to raise a ton of cash. The event costs about $350,000 to $400,000 to put on, mainly because the venue is very expensive. You can't charge the companies too much, or you won't get them, because they're mostly small companies. You can't charge too much to the public to get in, or you won't get the crowds you need to make the vendors happy. So that structural gap, that deficit that's built in there, you got to be creative and go out and beg and get some rich people or foundations to write checks. And, you know, that's part of my job, is to go find that. But the National Green Pages, you should check it out. And I would say for the cooperative distribution of products, that would be another place to look. Because I don't know personally, I wrote a funding proposal years ago to do this with African products, and I never raised enough money for it, or any money for it. And the idea was, let's have a centralized warehouse in the United States. There's a lot of people importing craft products from Africa, but it's all catch-as-catch-can. Let's centralize it, bring it in, and have a centralized distribution that would be more efficient. Because in our stores, we try to, as much as possible, go directly to these producer groups. But a lot of times you can't do that because they're so small and their institutional capacity is so underdeveloped that they can't handle it. You go to them and say, oh, this product that you're producing, we want 500 of them next month. And they say, we can only produce 50 a month. Their capacity is limited. So you have to a certain degree, deal with wholesalers who come in and consolidate. And the first place I would look is the Co-op America, the National Green Pages for that. Bird-friendly wind energy is, they're vertical. They look sort of like a double helix kind of thing. You know, they're vertical like this, and they've got, you know, things that catch the wind, and they spin. There's been people who have been working on this, because obviously people who are concerned about renewable energy and fossil fuel, climate destruction, etc., are also concerned about species destruction. It tends to be the same group of people. So there's a lot of people working seriously on it. But in all of these sectors, what you find is big corporations, somebody else mentioned this, big corporations are getting into it. General Electric, you'll see ads for their wind energy, right? And what they will do, and this is true of BP, British Petroleum, which now says, no, BP stands for Beyond Petroleum. Yeah, beyond my ass. You know, I'll believe it when I see it. Shell just invested about $500 million in solar, etc. What they want to do is they want to concentrate the production in big facilities and then sell the electricity. Well, the thing about wind and solar is that it's perfectly democratizable. You could have it on every building. In fact, in San Francisco, we passed a $100 million bond initiative. It was passed by 72% of the voters. $100 million bond issue to put solar energy and other renewable and conservation on all the public buildings. Right? Well, $100 million, you know, that's... And you can do that anywhere, because bond measures are put out to the voters all the time to build sewers, to build a school, to build a library, to build a park, whatever. So you say, let's do it for renewable energy. And even if you lose the vote, it gives you an excuse to go out and educate people in the parking lots of the stores and whatever about, hey, do you know about the renewable energy bond? And it turns out most people are in favor of it. It's easy to get it signed, the initiative, and get it on the ballot. Because people are in favor of saving the environment. The data shows that the overwhelming majority of people in this country do support saving the environment, which is why Bush has had to do all his environmental destruction of rules and regulations quietly and behind closed doors. They have destroyed hundreds of environmental regulations, right, to let these corporations pollute more of our air, our water, etc. And that stuff's ours. The commons belongs to us, as do the public airwaves. Right, which a lot of us think that's one of the biggest One of the biggest sources of pollution is the takeover of the public airwaves by the corporations. We own the public airwaves. And most people in this country don't understand what the corporate media are. They have it exactly reversed in their head. They've been told, we are the consumers. And the products being marketed are the tires and toothpaste in the ads. No. The consumers are the corporate advertisers who pay for that advertising. When you buy the Post Intelligence or the Seattle Times or whatever and you pay 50 cents or something, it costs about 10 bucks to make each one of those newspapers. What pays for it is all that crappy advertising, the Macy's bra ads every day, that soft porn that's in there, right? That's what pays for it. I used to do layout on the newspaper, and we would always lay out the advertising, and what was left was called the news haul. Right? The news haul. And then you fill it with an AP Wire story or some local puppy dog caught in a tree or cat or I don't know what the, you know, that crap, right? Stuff that doesn't really edify. Because the key consumer is the corporate advertiser. What's the product? Us. Our brains, our consciousness, our attention, right? Our values. So it's like slavery. Slavery was the marketing of human bodies. This is the marketing of human minds. Why is it that the price of half a minute on TV goes up on Super Bowl Sunday? Because they're delivering more brains to be polluted with these stupid messages, right? Buy this product. The subtext of all of it is you are incomplete, and this commodity, if you purchase this commodity, well, if you think about it, making money at a job, getting a paycheck, and then going to the store and buying stuff, that's easy to do. Love, compassion, community, that stuff's harder to do. So a lot of people take the easy way out, the lazy way, and they base their life on this treadmill of, I'm going to work this crappy job I don't like to pay for my car, because I need the car to get to this crappy job I don't like. You know, and it's like, well, do I see some circularity here, you know? And this is one of the reasons why there's a lot of psychological crisis in our society. I get a lot of guys my age coming in the office saying, hey, Kevin, you know, I hear about what you guys are doing, and I'm a successful lawyer, corporate, blah, 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 but I want to do something meaningful with the remainder of, not that they weren't doing something useful, but, you know, it's like, as you start to see the end of your time on this planet approach, you start to think about the use of each day. Right? So we get these volunteers who are very skilled people. A lot of them have a lot of resources, and they're now shifting their politics, realizing, hey, this can't go on the way it's going, Bush and destroying the environment, etc. Who chooses trade ministers? It's usually the president, right? Bush chooses Robert Zoellick, who was a former Enron consultant. He'll defend us, you know. I mean, these guys, usually the way you get up to here is by selling your soul. You have to prove that you are a corporate prostitute, basically. You know, that you'll sell yourself out, that you'll march in line and do the corporate bidding. When these guys sit down for their meetings, and it is mostly guys, I'm sad to say, it's all about money, and it's all about profit. It's not about preserving the environment or human rights. That's for the public presentation of the propaganda by the propaganda apparatus. But if you look at their documentation, I did my dissertation research on U.S. policy towards South Africa, and I managed to get the IMF and World Bank confidential reports on South Africa, and I piled up years of them. And you go through and you read the stack, and you don't see the word apartheid. It's analyzing the economy of South Africa, and it doesn't use the name of the system of labor control. How the hell do you do that? But they did it, because they do this. You know? They exclude the suffering, the injustice, etc. That can't go on. The price is too high for all of us. Resources for a business plan. There's the Social Enterprise Alliance, and there's the Co-op America Business Network, CABIN. When you go to the Co-op America website, you'll see the Co-op America Business Network. It's 2,000, over 2,000 companies. The Social Enterprise Alliance, we have a conference coming up in San Francisco in early March. This is nonprofits using enterprise to generate revenue to do good, rather than being dependent on the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation. These big foundations, with their corporate lawyers on their boards, will not fund revolution. They will fund charity. They will not fund revolution. They're into polishing the chains, not breaking them. Okay? I know, because I have to go and try and get money from them, and it's extremely difficult. Most of our foundation money comes from the small radical foundations, right? That's built in, that's structural, that's a big problem. Talk to me later about the bioplastics. I can help you out with that. If you give me your address, I can send you something that'll have that in there. World Social Forum, that's great you mentioned it. Oh, labeling and greenwashing. Of course corporations are going to take any pressure from us and try and spin it and do jujitsu, and we have to do the same thing. When they repress us, you know, we came back from Miami, you know, people going, oh man, FTAA, they repress, they tear gas us on. Well, is that the sign of a strong state or a weak state? If that behavior of the Miami police had happened in Moscow 15 years ago under communism, the bourgeois media would have said, look at that, communism is such a failure, they have to repress protesters in the street. But when it happens here, they blame the protesters. Imagine if the Rodney King riots had happened in Havana, Cuba. What would they have said in the press here? They would have said, see, socialism is a failure. Look at that, rioting in the streets. When it happens in the U.S., they say, these rioters are bad people. You see the double standard that they do? So when you are repressed, that is not all negative. You always have to do glass half empty. That's the critique of what they're doing. Glass half full is, you guys are such a bunch of lightweights that you can't come out and debate us. You got to tear gas us. If Dan and I are having a debate up on this stage and all of a sudden I punch him and knock him out, did I win the debate or did I lose the debate? I lost by default. You don't win a debate, a discourse, by suppressing the voice of the other side. It's why in Cancun, when we interrupted the opening ceremonies, when Supachai, the director, started to speak, we got up with black electrical tape over our mouths as a way of saying, you're silencing us. But we're going to screw up your opening ceremonies, because when we all stood up, about 50 of us, all the cameras turned toward us. And the next day in the newspapers, the main pictures were of us, and the WTO story was down in the corner. We pushed them off the front page. Right? That is now in our power to do. Imagine if you had a public relations firm, and you went to a corporation that was going to launch a new product. And you said to that corporation, how much will you pay us if we can put your new product on the front page of every newspaper in the world and have your product lead every radio and TV news story? They'd pay you huge amounts of money. We in the global justice movement can now do that. We put the WTO on the front page of every newspaper in the world. We drag the snake out from under the rock and say to the public, is this a poisonous snake? Is it a non-poisonous snake? You must decide, people. Because what they are doing is, and this is why I argue the World Trade Organization is the single most dangerous institution on the face of the earth, because they are writing a constitution for the entire planet. Bush is more obviously bad because he's out front, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to kill people. The WTO, but he'll be gone soon, right? He'll be gone. The WTO, yeah, he will be gone. He's cooked. He's done, right? Forget that. You know, everybody who's doing anybody but Bush, the left needs to shift now to create a center of gravity out to the left of Kerry. Because Kerry, I don't think there's any corporate special interest money in Washington that Kerry hasn't taken, okay? I'm sure he's a nice guy. Actually, one of his daughters was an intern of mine years ago. She was a very nice person. I'm not casting aspersions on the human being. But, I mean, you can see his politics from his voting record. You know, this is like Clinton light. And we had 8 years of Clinton, and that wasn't so great, right? Clinton was the one who destroyed welfare, bombed Sudan, all that other stuff. So let's not get too carried away. But the thing we need to do with greenwashing is, of course they're going to greenwash, and then we have to come back and critique the greenwash. And the green companies that we're working with, we got to push them in terms of their standards, right, to go more green and more socially responsible, etc. And that's a constant improvement model. You're always doing self-critique. We do this within Global Exchange, but it's a comradely critique. It's how do we help the team move forward, not, I'm better than you because I eat 100% vegan organic and you're only 90%. You know, it's not, we got to get away from that kind of stuff. That does not bring new people into the movement. It makes people go, God, you guys are a bunch of wackos. You know, we don't want to do self-marginalizing behavior. Okay, we want to make it a big party. When we do the Green Festival, we call it a party with a purpose. And once people come to it and they see, wow, this is cool, this is fun, you've got a guaranteed set of customers that are going to come back over and over, and it helps build the movement because they're going to go tell other people, wow, I saw this really cool thing about solar energy, and you know, you can get it on your own house, and a 30-year system gets paid off in 10 years, and then you get 20 years of free energy, and those ideas spread. We are going to win. You must believe that. We are going to win, right? And it's just a question of when. And most of us won't be alive to see it. It's going to be the next two generations or something. Our job is to make it as quick as possible. But what you can do in your own head to help you in that struggle is have a long-term vision. I.F. Stone used to say, if you expect an answer to your question during your lifetime, you're not asking a big enough question. So what we need to develop is the same consciousness that was possessed by the Masons who laid the first foundation layer of those huge cathedrals in Europe that took 400 years to build. They knew they wouldn't see the final product of their work, but they did very precise, solid work because they knew there was going to be a lot of weight come on top of it in the future. And we here alive now are responsible for laying the foundation layer of a future democratic global economy with no clear-cut forests, no endangered species, not one starving child. That will come about. The question is it going to take 150 years? Is it going to take 50 years? Will there have to be massive die-off first? But it will come about because we already have the ability to envision what it will look like. It's all the pieces already exist, and all we got to do is bring them together. And we will kick ass because as the Titanic is going down, we can do one of two things. We can scream and be, oh, your boat sucks! Or we can pull up alongside in a really cool solar-powered boat with a party going on deck, scantily clad people with drinks in their hand, dancing to cool music, and they will jump from the Titanic without us saying a word about their boat. Right? Thank you. Thank you very much.